I'm Kelly Larson. I read online about your time capsule, and I'm here to make a suggestion.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're not taking suggestions.
The Twilight books. It's a beautifully told saga of vampires, werewolves, and romance.
Ah, you are the person that's been emailing me about Twilight. I thought you would be younger. And a girl.
Well, I'm not. I'm older and a boy. Have you seen any of the Twilight movies?
No, I have not.
Well, let me describe them to you shot for shot.
Yes. Okay, you know what? All right, I'm gonna go do my work in the conference room because you guys are the worst.
You seem tense, Leslie. You know what you should do?
Read Twilight.
Read Twilight, yeah. Here.
Thanks.
Sometimes I think she's in the Volturi.
Welcome back to Remember Shuffle. We hope you're settling into a nice cozy autumn weekend. We're coming to you with another Remember Shuffle reading episode. Yes, that's right, we're bookworms now, and we've read the first volume of the sacred texts of Stephanie Meyer, Twilight. In our last episode, we talked about the Da Vinci Code, complained about how it was awful because it was entirely plot-driven. Well, this time, we have a book that's almost entirely emotions-driven, so that means we have to like it, right? Right? It's hard to emphasize the near universal scorn that Twilight received in the 2000s. If you're old enough, you might remember the meme phrase, "Still a better love story than Twilight," that can be posted to any photo of any two things, from wall outlets to Wilson and Tom Hanks from Castaway. So let's get into if that was justified or not.
It's Britney, bitch.
George Bush doesn't care about black people.
Our education, like such as in South Africa and Iraq, everywhere, like such as, and...
We sitting here, I'm supposed to be the franchise player, and we're in here talking about practice.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
Ouch, Charlie!
Our next door neighbors are foreign countries.
I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
You were a Twilight super fan back in the day.
As much as any person of my demographic was in the early 2000s in high school.
It's almost universal. I've spoken to so many women while I was preparing for this and reading the book. And basically all of them have read Twilight.
For the record, I am Team Jacob and I still stand by this right now.
Thank you. That is the correct opinion.
That's the correct opinion.
It's certainly the healthy opinion, I think.
Yes, it is the healthy opinion.
I mean, when presented with that binary, is the correct opinion. I consider myself Team Bella. I think she should work on herself a little bit.
I mean, like, honey, grow a backbone, get some confidence.
I'm not. I actually like to read Team Edward and Team Jacob fan fiction of the two of them getting together.
I wonder if there's a rule about who tops and who bottoms there. Because I know that in the Sherlock fanfic, one of the absolutely uncouth faux pas that you can do is making Sherlock top. Sherlock always bottoms in the Sherlock Watson fanfic.
In the fanfiction that I was reading, Jacob bottoms until he becomes an alpha in Breaking Dawn. And then at that point, he becomes the top. So.
There's some character development linked into that.
Yeah. That's a sign of some good fanfic right there.
Did the Omegaverse start because of Twilight? Are you guys familiar with the Omegaverse?
No, oh, what is that?
Okay, don't look it up.
I know that we got 50 Shades of Grey out of Twilight. I know that's an offshoot of the fanfic culture.
Yeah, it would have been tough to find a man to come on this one. I'm just remembering when I was in high school that there was a scene where something happened and all the women in the theater gasped and then all the guys asked, who's that guy again? Anyway, let's get started.
Hello, welcome to Remember Shuffle. My name is Ben. With me as always is my co-host Giordano. Say hi, Giordano.
Hello.
Joining us today is our expert guest, good friend of mine, Steph.
Hello, everyone.
Today we are discussing Twilight.
I'm so excited. Man, I want to suck your blood. I love Classic. Vampires, man. That's how Edward talks, right?
Yeah, definitely. Like the Count from Sesame Street.
It would have been a more compelling story, more compelling movie, I think, had he talked like that.
Oh, yeah. And had he been really into counting things?
Yeah, or if the Count on Sesame Street was like, little girl, you smell so good. It's intoxicating.
I learned recently that the Count from Sesame Street, according to internal memos at PBS, he is not officially a vampire, but he must be, quote, vampire-like.
Well, much like Carlisle's clan, I guess he's like a vampire that doesn't actually have to consume the flesh of humans.
Or Muppets. Or Puppets. Okay, so Jordana, why are we talking about Twilight today?
Well, you know, this is a 2000s podcast, and this is one of the cultural tour de forces of the decade. And I'm going to paint a little picture for you here, okay? It's the night of June 2nd, 2003, and a Mormon receptionist by the name of Stephanie Meyer awakes from a dream she has in a cold sweat. And the dream is about a girl who had fallen in love with a beautiful vampire. And the vampire was equally torn between his adoration for the girl and his desire to consume her flesh and blood. And so she starts writing what had happened in the dream. And within 3 months, she had written Twilight. And she wrote letters to 15 publishers trying to sell Twilight, only to be rejected by all of them but one. The only reason they accepted the manuscript was because of a mistake from the secretary. And within 10 years, Stephanie Meyer will have sold 100 million copies of the Twilight series and become the US's highest selling author of both 2008 and 2009. So this series blows up. If you were alive in that decade, you know that Twilight was everywhere, especially once the movies came out. Because the movie adaptations, when they're made in 2008, the first made $500 million, and then each of the four sequels successively made more money than the last. The series is a runaway freight train of success. By the end of the series, Breaking Dawn Part 2 made $1 billion at the box office and is the fourth highest grossing movie of 2011. So fourth, just for reference, that's right above The Avengers. That's how popular this movie is. It beat the fucking Avengers. Many people write off this series as being sort of drivel for teenage girls, but you don't beat out The Avengers by just appealing to teenage girls. And we're going to walk through the first Twilight installment and what made it so compelling to the culture of the 2000s.
It's wild that this thing almost didn't get made, that it slipped through the cracks in an act of inter-receptionist solidarity, I like to think. It wasn't a mistake.
Yeah, I like the idea of Mormon Jesus sort of like reaching down, imprinting this beautiful idea into humanity. We're going to introduce two ideas that drive the majority of the tension of the book. We're gonna walk you through the plot of Twilight, both the movie and the book. It's a fairly faithful adaptation. But there's this climax with neighboring vampires that's more of a traditional story structure. But that only happens in the last 20% of the book, which means that the first 80% of the book, all of the tension comes from these two ideas that we'll just walk you through before we move into the plot.
Yeah, the book is written in the first person. And it really should have been a third person limited narration because we don't need all of the thoughts. There are too many thoughts from Bella Swan.
I like the thoughts. Honestly, I think that's what spoke to me as a young person around the same age as Bella, hearing her thoughts. I'm like, I have these thoughts. I thought that was one of the most compelling parts of it for me.
For sure. I started reading this and I had a hard time getting into it. And then what I changed is every time I started reading, I just imagined myself to be like a teenage girl. And suddenly it got a lot more interesting. Oh, these high school dynamics between the existing social structure at Forks High School suddenly keep me on the edge of my seat. Who likes who? And little scenes when Bella comes up to Jessica. Anyway, we'll get into it. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. The two major themes that run through the plot, of course, is the Mormon edging fanfic. Sex. The book opens with a quotation from Genesis about how when you eat the apple, you will know of knowledge. It is about temptation. It's the Mormon edging book that took the non-Mormon edging world by storm. So this tension is expressed because they never consummate their relationship and they don't even talk about it really. They talk around it through the metaphor of blood-sucking murder, of consumption. And this is, of course, nothing new. Sex and death go hand in hand in vampire fiction. You know, the little death as orgasm. There's a long, proud tradition of this. And this is a very, very, very simple allegory for what is really being talked about, is not having sex, but wanting to really bad. And this is, of course, where a lot of the toxicity of the relationship comes from. The subtitle of Twilight could be, "Look what you almost made me do." In terms of how Bella is responsible for Edward's self-control. It's deeply fucked up in a lot of ways. And this is, we're not breaking new ground here. This is hardly a hot take.
And Taylor Swift intertext here.
Look
what you made me do. She peaked with 1989.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Strong disagree, but that's a whole nother episode.
Yeah. There's a lot of Taylor Swift Twilight overlap, I would imagine. They both speak to like this like small town idealization.
I mean, definitely this demographic overlap there.
So like I said, there's not a lot of plot and danger in the first 80% of the book. And so the first 80% is a lot of them staring at each other and being totally taken in by each other's beauty and wanting to go forward with physical intimacy or biting her. The biting her is a metaphor for physical intimacy. And Edward telling her, you don't know how hard this is for me.
You don't know how hard this is to be perfect, to be immortal, to have super hearing, to have super strength, to be able to drive my car super fast without any consequences, to be able to fucking fly. It's so hard. I feel like a monster.
And to read minds. He's got the special ability to like read people's minds, which is a huge part of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not Bella's.
No, that's what makes her special.
Bella, at some point in the book, she wants to become a vampire. And becoming a vampire is an allegory for sex, in that once you do it, it changes you in a way that you can't go back from, and that you're different, and in some way, in Edward's eyes at least, damaged and changed. Edward insists that they get married before she can become a vampire, which is pretty on the nose. Mm-hmm. And my guess is that when you're a teenager, especially as a teenage girl, the desire to be abstinent is that's when it's strongest in your life, possibly. And yet you are constantly presented with temptation and lust. And I think that a lot of people identify with Edward.
I think it's when society tells you you need to be most abstinent. I don't know if it's necessarily an innate inborn desire, but I think this is more like social forces that are telling you.
Yeah, especially if you're Mormon.
Yeah, Steph.
So I would argue, as someone that experienced firsthand, being a teenage girl, that's when society most scares you into saying that this is a bad idea, into saying that you cannot have sex willingly or to express you even want to have sex as a teenage girl. This is when everyone tells you this is what you should be most afraid of in your life. And that's so damaging because boys don't get, I mean, you can tell me, I don't, like, were you guys scared against having sex at any point? Like your whole life will change. You as a person will fundamentally change. Like you're all these risks.
No, you're pressured to do it. If you don't do it, you're a loser.
Right. But no, as young women, that's when we are most literally supposed to be scared shitless of this experience.
Mm-hmm. Right. And in the same way, Bella is supposed to be scared shitless of the idea of changing and becoming an immortal being.
And who tells her this? Edward. Continues, right. Especially during the movie I just watched. At multiple times, he's like, you should be afraid of me. Let me show you the ways that you should be afraid.
Okay. So just keep that in mind. As we're going through the plot, keep in mind that they're always on the edge of her wanting Edward to bite her and him saying, no, I want to, but I can't do it. And then the second through line, I think, throughout the book is this idea of danger and attraction being linked. So Edward, as you mentioned, is constantly telling Bella, I'm dangerous. I love you intensely, but it's taking everything I have not to kill you. And when I first started reading this, I was like, damn, I do not understand women. Like thinking about like Ted Bundy and all like the true crime that women love. But then I realized that Stephanie Myers is not necessarily endorsing this type of relationship. She's merely exploring that this feeling and attraction does exist in real life. And why are we so into this idea of being scared of a romantic partner?
The difference between what you find attractive when you're young and a little bit less mature, you're attracted to, if not necessarily danger, like, ooh, this man has killed people. It's getting me turning my crank, but it's mystery. It's the brooding, beautiful, mysterious man or person, potential partner, has some kind of attraction when you're younger and immature. And then you figure out that what might matter also is stuff like shared values and someone who is a little bit grounded, someone who doesn't hold you responsible for not murdering them. You know, the little things.
And you have to keep in mind that Edward is hot. He's a hot guy. He's godlike. He's perfect. He's like a male model. All words that Stephanie Myers uses to describe Edward Cullen. And so...
Yeah, she says he looks like a Greek god. She uses the word Adonis. Yeah, this move, the brooding, mysterious move, it only works for 9.25s and above. Don't try this. This is hot person privilege.
Did you guys look up what the last name Cullen means?
No.
It means beautiful in Gaelic. I mean, also Bella, her first name, like obviously also means beautiful. These are two beautiful people spiraling in this like beautiful vortex of whatever.
As Stephanie Meyer said, it would start like that. It's like two beautiful people in a beautiful vortex of beauty admiring each other's beautifulness. Get this woman a thesaurus, please.
15% of the words in this book are describing how beautiful Edward and Bella are. For
but
sure.
She can't actually do it. She's like, he's perfect. He's flawless. She describes him through the absence of stuff. Reading this gave me body dysmorphia, man.
Well, I think this also, I probably plays into like the teenage psyche. Find me a teenager that doesn't have some form of body dysmorphia. And here's a story about two seemingly perfect. Like, of course you want to read that. Of course you want to idealize this. This makes sense.
And I'm going to defend Stephanie Meyer here because I feel like...
Is it Meyer or Myers?
Meyer.
Meyer. Okay, I've been saying it wrong.
Yeah, she's not Jewish, Ben.
I think the Mormons think that they're Jews. I think that's part of their really? I think they think they're like, or no, they call it
Zion, I guess.
Yeah, right. I think they think they're one of like the 12 lost tribes or whatever. I don't know.
Oh, interesting.
The Mormons are wacky.
Have they looked at themselves in the mirror? Oh. So I want to defend Stephanie Meyer here and just say that incels and people like to make a lot of hay and point out how women's preferences are wrong by pointing to these abusive chads and saying that, oh, like, you know, women don't find the right things attractive. But I just want to defend her by saying that this is just human nature. It's present in both sexes. And so I think that all people, especially when they're younger, find themselves drawn towards dangerous and unstable people. And there was a study published in the Journal of Personality and Individual Differences titled Borderline Personality Traits in Attractive Women Are Relatively Favored by the Opposite Sex. It was performed on over 500 people, and it found that when presented with two attractive hypothetical women, men will actually gravitate towards the ones with borderline personality disorder. So how many times have you heard a guy claim that a woman is more exciting in bed because she's crazy or because she has daddy issues, right? The movie Casino is probably the best example of how like a mentally unstable woman can appeal to a man's baser desires for thrill. And this is all to say that when it comes to hot people, all bets are off with respect to mental stability. Human beings crave emotional stimulation, and the random unexpected habits of a dangerous person feed that need for excitement.
Yeah, I want to dispute this study. This seems like one of the studies that, this is like A, one of those studies that can't be replicated, and B of all, highly unquantifiable. What is the metric unit to measure borderline personality traits? What is like...
They wrote it into the bio. It was like, oh, I like to flout the rules, or they wrote borderline personality traits into the person's bio, essentially.
Also, like, what was the control here? Like, what?
Listen, you guys can take it up with Dr. Barney Stinson, who published
the paper. I will say, though, maybe I shouldn't say this on this podcast, but my grandmother had borderline personality disorder. She had 5 husbands, so.
Yo!
She's very beautiful. That's all I'm saying.
Your grandma had fucking game, dude.
She did. 5 husbands.
And, is she still alive? Could she?
Yeah, what's her number? Tell her to hit me up. I'm just making this point because I feel like people rip on Twilight a lot by being like, women are dumb and she likes this asshole who wants to kill her and is gaslighting her. And it's like, this isn't a woman thing. This is just human nature. And it's something that Stephanie Meyer is commenting on. This illogical need for us to be with someone who excites us in a way that is bad for us. And I think that that's something that Twilight really gets right. And I really enjoyed while reading it.
Here's a little note for the listener. Anytime you run into one of these fucking nice guys, it's like, oh, women won't have sex with me, but they love the asshole. Whatever. The number one thing that you can say to just deflate them, to pop their fucking little balloon, is you just ask them genuinely. And you've worked on yourself to completion. This is the best version of you we're gonna get. Like, you're not gonna read or hit the gym or travel or, you know, become more interesting or whatever. And they won't be happy. They will yell at you, but you'll ruin their day. So that's a little tip for the listener.
Pro tip.
So as we move through the plot, you know, every time we mention Edward holding Bella, you know, just keep in mind that Meyer is mentioning as often as possible that Bella's scent triggers Edward into a violent frenzy, and only his intense love for her is keeping him from squashing her like a mosquito.
Goals. Hashtag goals.
And I'm not faulting Meyer for this because I don't get mad at Scorsese for making movies about toxic mobsters. So why would I get mad at Meyer for making a movie about a toxic relationship?
It comes down to, the baby-brained take of art, which is any portrayal of anything in art is a tacit approval of it, which is just wrong and baby-brained and dumb.
Why should a 16-year-old have the wherewithal wherewithal already to be able to make good decisions about what a good partner is.
Yeah.
Why should we fault her for that?
Let's describe our two star-crossed lovers, their characters, before we get into the plot. I think Bella Swan is there for the reader to kind of project onto, because the book makes a lot of hay about all of her negative traits. You know, when you're feeling insecure and inadequate, you can look at Bella Swan. She says, "I make the cowardly lion look like the Terminator." She's not very brave. That's a real sentence a real human adult wrote. She's klutzy and uncoordinated. The movie goes ham on this. She keeps having to play sports, both in the book and the movie, and she's just bad at every sport. She's klutzy, she's uncoordinated.
Yeah, so Bella's really characterized as a klutz. It seems to be like her most defining feature. And that to me is like a very 2000s way to give a flaw to like a physically perfect woman. You know, it's like, because it's a physical thing. It's not even like an emotional thing. And so I think now that's changed. Now you just give them IBS. I feel like that's the hot girl flaw now instead of being a klutz.
She's socially inept and easily flustered. And of course she is just generally kind of an absolute wet blanket Debbie Downer. Early on in the book, there's a scene where in this small town where it gets more rain than any other place in the continental United States, it finally snows and it's a break. And everyone around Bella is so happy. They're throwing snowballs and Bella just pouts about the snow the entire time. Just real, real Debbie Downer energy Bella brings to those around her.
Mm-hmm. Maybe she's got sad. She's from Arizona. Her mom just moved to Florida. Maybe she'd never been like a dark place before.
Maybe Bella, this whole thing could have been stopped if she got one of those UV lights for seasonal affective disorder.
Steph, what's your opinion? Do you think that Bella is well characterized?
Well, this is such a difficult question because then you have to go into what makes a good character, right? Like, is it the baseline of the character? Is it how the character develops? Is it how...
Having describable psychological traits. A good character to me is,
yeah,
I could put them in a room and I know how they'll react, right? I can put Kramer in a room and I have a pretty good idea of how he'll react. You know, like he's going to start yelling at black people or something.
Yeah, I think we know how Bella's going to react in any sort of social situation. It's not going to be good. It's not going to be pretty. It's going to be cringy to behold, which is what we get in the movie. However, I will say that I think her traits are very malleable and that any sad teenager who reads this book is going to see themselves in her. It's easy enough to map on her own insecurities onto her because, like you said, Jordana, all they do is list her negatives. And if there's a deeply self-conscious 16-year-old reading this book, that's what she's going to do.
She's our narrator. We hear all of her thoughts. And her star-crossed lover is Edward Cullen, who we can really blitz through this because we only get Bella's perspective. And what we know is that he is an absolute fucking himbo Adonis thought. He's mysterious and brooding. And of course, we can have some fun with some adjectives here. You could say he is quite protective or he's a stalker. You know, depending on how you want to read this. He's also kind of quick to anger. There's a scene where he asks Bella to calm him down to keep him from literally murdering people. Again, that look what you almost made me do energy. And in some respects, he's, despite being an immortal vampire who has killed people, he's kind of a conscientious rule follower where he insists on introducing Bella to his vampire family. He insists on meeting Charlie, the dad.
And they talk about this because he's from the turn of the century and the turn of the 20th century. These are he died of what, Spanish influenza?
Yeah.
These are like old customs that he had as a human, and he's trying to preserve that in his immortal life now. So that's why he's doing all these old school things like courting Bella and all that whatever bullshit.
Yeah.
Stephanie Meyer likes to describe Twilight as being like an Emily Bronte-esque novel, and maybe some of his older sensibilities play into that.
I disagree with that characterization so hard with this book, but who am I?
I've never read Wuthering Heights.
Well, I think we can map on the toxic relationships in both novels, so I think we can do that there.
Gotcha. Yeah. But also, she writes Edward very broadly. I read this after the movie had come out, so I had already associated Robert Pattinson. Did you read this before the movie came out? Did you have a face in mind when you were reading this for the first time?
No, actually.
I mean, I think she's a bad writer in a lot of ways, but it does let the reader project whatever they find most beautiful onto Edward. In the same way that the best horror monster is not a monster, is where you fill in the cracks with your own imagination of what you find scariest. Mm. This is like you get to fill in the cracks of what gets you most goaded. what turns you crank the most?
Yeah, absolutely.
Stephanie Myers herself, she had Henry Cavill in her head when she was writing it.
Same situation, just like very blockish model.
So those are our two star-crossed lovers. And let's go through the story beats. What happens in Twilight? We'll do the story beats, and then we'll talk themes like we normally do. So Bella Swan has just moved from Arizona to Forks, Washington on the Olympic Peninsula, where it rains more than any other place in the continental United States. She's moving in with her dad, Charlie, as a high school junior. She lives in this small rural town for the first time. Her dad is the local sheriff, and Bella only refers to him by his first name in her eternal monologue. She only calls him Charlie, and she even sometimes almost calls him that to his face. Charlie, he likes to fish. I think he's better in the movie than he is in the book, and he's a very hands-off and passive parent, but he does want Bella to not date till she gets to college. He wants these kind of rules and roles, but again, takes no interest whatsoever in raising his daughter. He's very awkward around her.
He is. He's such a nothing. He's like, well, Bella, have fun at school and come back after if you want.
I don't want to crowd you.
Yeah.
So Bella goes to high school, and immediately all of the dudes are into her. Three different non-vampire dudes are throwing themselves at Bella, and the ladies are jealous of her, but Bella doesn't see it because, like the One Direction song says, she doesn't know how beautiful she is. Everyone immediately wants to be friends with her, including Mike. Mike is one of the three friend-zoned guys who's there. Again, I think better in the movie than in the book. And she finally meets our brooding vampire, Edward Cullen, the godlike, perfect male model-esque classmate that she sits next to in biology. And he just stares intensely at her. And yet she doesn't know why. Then he disappears. He's going to do this a lot. This is what the first 80% of the book is before the conflict with the other vampires come. It's a lot of staring at the beauty. And then Edward disappears for a while. And then Bella thinks about it for a whole bunch and agonizes and overthinks and what have you.
Yeah. And then this mysterious Adonis is paired up to be Bella's science partner, Edward Cullen. But on their first day as lab partners, when Bella gets close, he appears disgusted by her and leaves class. Now, if you're Bella, you know, you're feeling bad. There's this hot guy and he's staring at you with this face. You can't quite make out the expression, something between obsession and disgust. And you're thinking, I finally got a chance to be close to him and he hates me. He's disgusted by me. You're feeling bad, okay? You're thinking, what did I do? Was it something I said? No one will ever like me. So there's a lot of emotions being cooked up in the slow cooker right now. We got a stew going here.
Straight teenage logic, right? It's like, you seem like doing nothing wrong, but you also think that the problem is you. Like, here's this really adverse reaction that makes no actual logical sense, but you're the problem, not whatever reaction this weirdo's having.
Mm-hmm.
Teenage logic. Yeah.
Yep.
And just to give a shout out to Mike for a second, I think he's one of the more characterized characters of the book, because right from the get-go, he's obsessed with Bella. He's the guy who's offering to carry her books around, and like, it's just so clear that he's romantically interested in her. But then because she's interested in Edward, he sort of gets friend zoned. And that's the source of a lot of humor and sort of cringe, especially in the first half of the book that I enjoyed.
Yeah, it's painful, dude.
Before she pawns him off on Jessica.
Yeah. Jessica, who in the movie is played by Anna Kendrick. Mike is doing well.
Yeah. You have this really, you're really into Anna Kendrick for some reason. I don't see it, but you're a Kendrick head.
I mean, Pitch Perfect is a great fucking movie, dude. This is, at a certain point, one of the big set piece scenes, Bella is nearly killed by a car skidding out of control, and Edward uses his vampire powers to save her life. And then he tries to gaslight her into thinking that nothing out of the ordinary went down, right? You didn't see anything. I was standing right there. And this is before we all knew what gaslighting was, before it was in the public consciousness. And throughout this chunk the book, he's real on again, off again presence, because anytime the weather improves, anytime there's a sunny day, Edward needs to go camping with his family, because in the Twilight universe, sunlight doesn't kill vampires, but rather makes them sparkle. It outs them, you would be known. So again, a hallmark of an abusive relationship is being emotionally withholding, withdrawing at some points, but the book gets to cover its ass by using the weather and the vampire lore to do that.
Yeah, and one of the best scenes in the meet cute so far between these two is that they're lab partners, right? And Bella has already done this lab before and she knows the answers. And so she's sort of impressing him with her knowledge of mitosis. And at a later point in class, she passes out at the sight of blood. She's very squeamish around blood, which is played to some humorous effect throughout the book. But Mike offers to take her to the nurse's office. But when you know it, Mike's not strong enough to carry her, sadly. You know, he's a soy boy. And so who shows up? And despite her protestations, he picks her up and, you know, he makes her feel like she's 10 pounds instead of 110 pounds. And he carries her to the office as she keeps telling him to put her down. And this is the first time where we get some real like emotional intimacy between these two. It's very sweet. I really like that part.
But also it's sweet that's covered up with a moment of non-consent. Like she was like, don't pick me up, put me down, put me down, put me down. And he still did it.
I know that part always, I think it does screw with people, guys, especially when you're growing up, you see stuff like this in movies where some guy chases after a woman to the airport and stuff like that. And it's like, oh, is this what I should do? No, you shouldn't.
No.
But the people on the screen should.
Like, yeah. Different set of rules.
If you're a 9.25 or above, maybe. You
So at a certain point during one of Edward's absences, Bella goes on a surf trip and she meets Jacob, who's going to be an important presence in later books. Mm-hmm. Jacob is a member of the Quileute tribe, mm-hmm. and he is the first one to really talk about the vampire angle. Now, unless you're like a total baby brain and you didn't read the back cover of the book, you as the reader have known about the vampire stuff that's happening. But Bella, the character who isn't so good at pattern recognition or cause and effect, she learns of the vampires, the cold ones, as they are called in the Quileute lore. And this finally puts her on the path to putting the puzzle pieces together, talking with Jacob, who's very nice and will eventually form part of the love triangle in later. And it turns out his tribe is made up of werewolves, but we save that chunk of the lore for the later books. That doesn't actually happen in book one. And eventually, Bella and Edward fall in love. And it happens about as quickly as that sense did. It's intense teenage passion. Romeo and Juliet style.
Does happen very quickly. I don't know if you guys remember having feelings for people as a teenager. Like, it does happen that quickly, at least in my experience. And it doesn't always have to be founded on any sort of actual logic, which is
more true.
Any kind of logic or, you know, emotional connection.
Well, you know what's funny is, because I was like you, Ben, I was very skeptical of like how quickly she falls in love with him and is like, I want to be with you forever. To us, that's an alien feeling. The idea of being 16 and being like, I love you so much, I want to be with you forever. To a Mormon, this is the most normal part of the book. Stephanie Meyer got married at 21.
Yeah, if I may quote the sacred text, Bella is, quote, unconditionally and irrevocably in love with him. Nice SAT word there, Stephanie Meyer. That irrevocably, that's fancy for no take backsies. Okay. Yes, so they fall in love. And at a certain point, Bella goes to a different town to go book shopping, and she is accosted by some street harassers. And Edward comes with his car, saves her, gets her away from the street harassers. Here's where the book and movie get pretty dark. Edward implies, because he does have the ability to read minds, Edward implies that those street harassers were about to back alley rape and murder Bella. That's what was in their brain minds. Of course, it's a Mormon teen book, so he doesn't use those words. It's gestured. It's like, if you could see what was in their minds, you'd be scandalized. And then he asks Bella to calm him down so that he doesn't go berserker mode on them.
Hold me back, bro. Hold me back.
Hold me back. Hold me back. And, you know, just red flag after red flag being revealed. A non-comprehensive, non-exhausted lift would include him saying her blood smells so tasty to him that in that first day in bio class, that was the hardest he ever thought of relapsing and drinking human blood. Number two, he watches her sleep every night because of his own protectiveness. Number three, he can't read her mind for reasons. She's the only person whose mind he can't read. So instead, he reads the mind of literally every other person around her so that he's aware of every conversation she has with her friend, with her dad, with everyone. They try and make jokes laughing at poor Mike. Laughing at poor friend zone Mike.
did you guys read Midnight Sun?
No.
You know what that is?
No.
That's the one where they flip it, right?
Yeah. So it's Twilight from Edward's perspective. Right. And it was the first 10 chapters were leaked like several years ago. So then Stephanie Meyer's like, I'm never going to actually publish this. Here it is for free. Read it. But to go back to the scene with these back alley potential rape scenes, this is very explicit from Edward's perspective because you get to actually see and read what these guys' thoughts were.
Mm.
It's interesting to see it from, it doesn't, what's interesting I think about Mendes Hunt is it doesn't sound as stalkery, I guess, from his perspective. You know, this is exactly what he's doing, but it's very apologetic to his activities because from his perspective and from his perspective, he's not this crazy stalker, toxic relationship person. He's
just, I'm a nice guy. I'm looking out for you.
Exactly. That's exactly how he characterizes his actions in himself.
And I know she did a gender flip one too. Stephanie yeah. Meyer playing the hits, going to the well of Twilight. Their gender flip names are Bo instead of Bella. I guess she's Southern in this iteration. Or he, sorry, it's the dude. Bo Swan. Yeah, no, it's, yeah, it still means beautiful. I forget how she feminizes the name Edward. I think it's like
Edwina. That's a name, right?
Yeah. That's for sure a name.
Yeah, that means beautiful in Slavic, old Slavic.
In old true Slavonic. Throughout this period, now they're finally in a couple.
Mm-hmm.
They go out to dinner after the attempted rape-based kiss, I think, around this time. And gradually, Edward reveals more and more of his life and the history of his little vampire coven. He lives with 6 vampires that we didn't really describe, but he has an adopted father and mother, and then 4 other vampires who go to the same high school as he and Bella. And so gradually, we get some of the vampire lore. And this is one of the things that I actually liked about the book and the movie, because vampires are objectively cool. I have watched all of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, as has Steph, I know. Yeah, and so really diving down deep into the lore, Edward got saved when he was dying of the Spanish influenza, and his father, Carlyle, he goes all the way back to Shakespeare's London, and the vampire who beat him spoke Latin, so you get this chain of ancient vampire lore history. This is also where you get the iconic scene of vampire baseball, which is awesome, because of course they play baseball. They're all 100 years old. That was the sport of the 1920s or whatever, and they play baseball with their vampire powers.
You're skipping over some of the teenage girl pathos, I think, here, which is that...
Sorry, I went right to the lore.
Well, when they first meet, they each trade off on a day where they're allowed to ask each other a bunch of questions. And so Edward sort of makes this agreement with her that, hey, I'll answer every question you have, but then tomorrow it's all about you. And I'm going to ask you 1,000 questions. And this is when they first start dating, and they essentially spend a whole day, and Edward wants to know everything about her. Favorite color, favorite movie, everything. He's got a million questions. He just wants to know her so well. And I thought that was very cute. I was like, damn, I want Edward to be my boyfriend, and I want him to ask me a million questions.
Yeah, I thought this was one of the better moments of communication between the two of them, because also it was an equal exchange. It was they swapped off days. They can ask each other anything. There was an understanding. I thought this was one of the better examples, the better moments of their relationship.
Yeah, I think you just need friends. You want me to ask you some questions? I know you pretty well because I've known you for fucking 20 something years now, but I can ask questions if you're feeling lonely. And I will say, while I love the lore, the exposition is the clunkiest exposition I've seen since Game of Thrones sexposition scenes. It's like, they don't spread it out. It doesn't come naturally. They walk into Carlyle's office and it's like, oh, here's a painting of London in the 1600s. Speaking of which, oh, geez, Louise. This is, come on.
Like, if this were a musical, this would be the musical number with all the exposition in it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll put this here, but all the vampire lore is one of the parts I really enjoy about the Twilight series in general. I just find that, much like Harry Potter, there's this sort of secret institution of like vampires that has existed for thousands of years, and they have rules and laws and factions, and that stuff I found to be very interesting. Having some kind of lore in the world is always very cool, and I think they build on that a lot throughout the rest of the series.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It gives them more runway.
I agree.
Yeah. So the climax of the novel comes when a mean vampire comes to town, because Edward and his vampire coven, they don't drink human blood. They only hunt animals. They call themselves vegetarians. A mean vampire comes to town, and they decide to hunt down and murder Bella.
Remember, this is 80% of the way through the book.
Yeah.
You're 80% through, and now you're presented with the villain of the story. The movie is structured a bit more like a traditional story in that they hint at the introduction of a villain throughout the film. her dad keeps coming across these murdered people, and it's building towards something. But I think Stephanie Meyer, maybe because she was a first-time author, doesn't adhere to like a typical story structure.
It also has one of my favorite biggest laughs of the film where, yeah, sprinkled throughout the film, though we always keep our eyes on the climax prize, we have these grisly murders that Bella's father, the sheriff, is investigating. And at one point, there's a grisly murder that someone got fucking eaten. They think animals did it. And Bella's father sitting in a diner, it's like, yeah, well, the footsteps were pointed east, so I've just handed the information to the next county over there. Man, this is implicitly, this is an ACAB movie, okay? This is the lazy cop is like, not my job. The footsteps of the serial killer were pointed east, so washing my hands of this, Pontius Pilate style. This is actually where I stopped reading the book. This is as far as I made it.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't finish it. I'm sorry.
I mean, the last 20%, I think, is probably the most compelling in a way, because there's actually danger and there's a problem that has to be solved. You know,
and
there's
stakes.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah, there's stakes.
That is a vampire pun, by the way. Intentional vampire pun.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's an elaborate, almost like a heist or something. You're trying to outwit your opponent. They're trying to outwit you. It's pretty good.
And one thing that I will quibble with the vampires of the Twilight universe is they don't have any of the traditional weaknesses of a vampire. So Carlisle has a cross in his house, so they're not burned by the cross. In the movie, when Bella goes over there, they cook human food for her, and they're cooking Italian food. It's filled with garlic, so they're not put off by garlic. Sunlight just makes them sparkle. It doesn't kill them. But in this quite sanitized, Mormonized version of vampires, you know how they're killed? You need to be dismembered limb from limb and burned with fire.
Yeah, their only weakness was fire, which I think is traditional vampire weakness, but it's the only one that's retained in this world.
Yeah. That passes the Buffy test. I believe fire doesn't mean in Buffy too.
They play with those expectations for vampires to humorous effect sometimes. She goes over to Edward's house, and it's like a very modern, rich person's house. Big windows, open concept flooring. And he's like, oh, what were you expecting? Coffins and cobwebs?
Yeah. So the climax of the book is Bella is saved. Edward and his family managed to kill the hunter. But the real climax is that in the climactic battle, Bella is bitten by the hunter vampire. And Edward needs to suck the poison out of her, but not to completion. He needs to the fucking edge. He needs to not succumb to temptation. One of those key themes that we talked about in the intro. And the book ends with them going to prom together. Bella explicitly asks to be turned into a vampire, and he says no. And that's how book one of the Twilight Saga ends. I rate this novel AB positive.
I want to add a couple details. One, to the climax, every vampire has a special power. And James, his power, who's the villain, is that he's a tracker. And so he can track her no matter where she is. And so he starts going after Bella's loved ones. And Bella selflessly decides to go directly to the tracker. And she sort of absconds from Edward and his family because she doesn't want anyone else to get hurt, which I thought was very selfless, sort of like Harry Potter, in order to save her mother and her father. And when she's poisoned by the venom, Edward has to suck it out, and it's obviously very difficult for him because vampires react to blood the way sharks do, where they have this sort of involuntary frenzy. And so, you know, you're on the edge of your seat in the climax because Edward has to suck the toxins out of Bella's system, but doing that is almost impossible for a vampire. And so he's the only one that can do it because he's the only one that loves her enough to ignore his primal instinct to keep drinking the blood. And I thought that was very sweet. I teared up a little bit during that part. Yeah, because who else would be able to do this? Who else would be able to start sucking someone's blood and then stop? Only Edward would be capable of that because he loves her so much.
You sound like a Team Edward psycho, dude. This is...
I am Team Edward. I think it's maybe I'm maladjusted, unfortunately. Oh, no. I want that excitement.
Oh, no. No, I think to add to your point, Bella's got her specific blood sense. Apparently there's a phenomenon where certain vampires latch on to a very specific scent and they almost can't control themselves completely. And Bella for Edward has a specific blood type, I guess, that sends him into a literal involuntary frenzy. The fact that he's able to doubly do this, not just because he's streaking blood, but because it's Bella's specific blood is supposed to really spell out how much he loves her.
Yeah, that's why I was tearing up. And Ben, you're made of stone. How do you think Edward was able to stop? That's such a difficult thing for him. He's so into her blood, her floral blood.
You don't get points for discipline, man.
Ben, was there no point of the novel or the book that made you tear up? Because I have a point that made me tear up, but I'll share after.
No, I did not. I did not like this book. I was telling Jordana recently, this book, I disliked reading this book so much. It made me look back at human history. It made me look back at the barbarian invasions of the steppe by the Mongols and Huns, destroying settled peoples in their life ways. I looked at all the illiterate heroes of the past demolishing these readers. And I was like, you know what? They're not so bad. The written word led to this.
This is a very dramatic reaction to this novel.
It made me team illiteracy.
We
need to get back to an oral culture, because no oral culture would ever produce something like Twilight.
Oh boy.
Steph, can I guess at what the part that you teared up during was?
Please.
Was it when she's talking to Charlie and giving him the "get out of here, I don't want you anymore" speech?
Yes, it was. How did you know this? I can't deal with sad dads. I can't do it. Like, sad. Also, Charlie's just trying his best. I don't know. He's not doing a great job. He's just trying his best. And
she really uses the perfect tools to hurt him. So just to keep the listener informed on what we're talking about here, when she's being tracked, she needs to leave Forks, obviously, to get away from her father. And so she needs to give her dad a reason why she's leaving town. Mm-hmm. And she tells him, I don't want to live here anymore. And she gives him the same speech that she knows her mother gave her dad when she left, which is like, this town is suffocating me. I can't be here anymore. And, you know, poor Charlie is just like, but, you know, I guess if that's how you feel, then...
He's like, we can do more together. I'll be less boring. He's like, just killed me. Just killed me. But yeah, that is part that got me.
Yeah, that was very sad.
Poor Charlie.
Arguably one of the better characters.
He could stand to parent a little more. I mean, we should bear in mind he is pretty much an absentee father. Like, let's not have too much.
I like Charlie. I think he improves as being a dad. I think he gets on board with supporting Bella. I don't know.
He can stand to fish a little less. Okay. This is
they got a freezer full of fish already.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, as someone that was raised by a fisherman, I don't know. I think they need to go fish when they need to go fish.
All right, so we've now summarized the plot and given our thoughts on the story of Twilight in both novel and movie form. We did it in a tight, probably fucking 40 minutes or whatever it'll turn out to be. So let's talk about some major themes that undercut it. And I think the first one that we need to talk about, even if it might be well-trodden and hack, is we got to talk about the gender politics of Twilight. We've already gestured to a whole bunch of this stuff, but yeah, it's a Mormon view of what sexual relations should be, in that you must wait. You must resist the temptation. That is certainly one aspect of the gender politics that definitely comes through, even through vampire allegory in this book.
Yeah, and we should mention as well that Edward is technically born in 1900. He's bitten during the Spanish flu, so he's like 100 years old.
The precise number, there's an 87-year age gap between the two of them.
They're subscribed to our age gap on Reddit.
Is that a real subreddit?
It is, yeah. You know, a lot of girls say, I'm into older guys, but Bella is really taking this to its logical conclusion.
Yeah.
Guys her age, they're just not mature. Sure. What she likes is a nice 108-year-old man.
I mean, arguably, you can almost say that while Edward is 100 and whatever years old, like, he's frozen in time as a 17-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Critical thinking, I don't think, ever really develops based on that he's making.
And yeah, like, that's how I accepted it. Is like his like brain and maturity level is also locked in at a 17-year-old level.
I think so too, which sounds horrific because all 17-year-olds are kind of psychos, right? Could you imagine being a psycho forever and like having to say in this?
Part of the vampire lore is that, you know, when you become a monster, a lot of vampires contemplate suicide. Carlisle tried in the book. I feel like if you had to be 17 for forever with all those feelings, yeah, I could see why you would attempt suicide. Mm-hmm.
This makes it, I think, a little bit more interesting because in the later books, I talk about vampire children. Did you guys read the later books and know what I'm talking about?
I read a synopsis.
But please, this is why we have you on the pod. Please elaborate.
Oh boy, okay. So the whole dilemma to Bella being pregnant in the last book is because there was a phenomenon where someone made a bunch of vampire children and they did not have the wherewithal to control themselves because they had no critical thinking, they had no rational thought. So they're frozen in time as these baby murder machines. So there became in the vampire politics, it became illegal to turn children. So go back to turning a 17-year-old. If the logic is that this baby has no way of growing or adapting or like having their mental abilities change to be able to control themselves, neither can the 17-year-old boy.
What you're saying is that the vampire legislative body needs to raise the age of vampire consent.
Yes, I think that's got to be it, because otherwise you have these psycho 17-year-olds who then want to marry other 16-year-olds and are making decisions for them.
Yeah.
We thought it was very funny that Edward, he sort of acts like a modern teenager for the most part, when his formative years were the 1910s. The music that you're into typically is the music that was popular in high school. We just did an episode on emo music, that which I'm sure has a special place in all of our hearts, but they're listening to the radio at one point in this book, and he's like, oh, I like music from the 50s. And it's like, no. Edward would actually like music from like the 1910s.
He'd be listening to piano ragtime.
Well, he does at one point. He composes music. Like, he's a piano player. That's like a big part of his character. Like he makes Bella like her own like melody. Like, that's in the
right too. Because he's perfect. He composed a symphony for her.
In this scene, he disparaged the 80s. And I was just like, I knew it. Like, Edward, I knew it.
Mm-hmm. I had to imagine in that prom scene, Edward makes a request. It's like, no, guys, my song's gonna slap. And then it's just like, town races or some shit.
He's like, I just met this girl, Bella, she's got great gams, I want to take her to a vaudeville show.
Have we not touched on the fact that also Bella did not want to go to prom? She explicitly said that she did not want to go, and Edward made her.
She skips the semi-formal dance too.
Yeah, because she doesn't want to be at some weird dance, because she's a deeply awkward, socially inept person.
Yeah, and it's funny. I can see a world where it's like, hey, Bella, you should consider getting out of your comfort zone and growing or whatever. But that is not the energy that Edward brings to anything. Oh. It's like, no, you have to do this.
You have to do that.
Yeah, and New Moon ends as well with Bella being like, bite me, please, just bite me. And Edward says, I'll agree to bite you on one condition. We get married first. That's an on-the-nose sex metaphor if I ever heard one.
Yeah. Sorry, New Moon is such a problematic book for me. I like it because it introduces Jacob a lot, because it's more Jacob heavy than Edward heavy. I think Jacob is a much better character for both Bella as a potential partner, but also just all around more likable person. But the fact that Bella just goes completely despondent because he leaves is so damaging. Because young women are going to read this like, is this the love I should feel for a partner, that when we break up, I just become catatonic for several months? No, you should not. Like, that's terrible.
I mean, you shouldn't, but you do. That is kind of what happens.
Sometimes.
And yeah, she definitely does have the far healthier relationship with Jacob. They like fix a car together and
the more equals, even though he's also like a supernatural being, he never holds out above her. He doesn't really mention it unless he has to.
I love the passion you're bringing to Team Jacob.
12 years later, I feel very vindicated from these conversations I had in a high school cafeteria.
I didn't think Team Jacob people actually existed. I thought they were just like mythological creatures, like a werewolf or something.
No, we're here.
See, Team Jacob just had to wait around for society to improve a little bit, for people to learn what gaslighting was, and they needed Me Too to happen for Team Jacob to go mainstream. I don't want to make this joke because I'm worried my family will find this pod at some point, but if you were a woman who was on Team Edward, you probably enjoy being choked during sex now. And there's nothing wrong with that. We're not kink shaming here, but just probably that's, you know.
I'm Team Edward. I mean,
you can have whatever kind of sex you want, Jordano. I won't judge you.
But it's always going to be Edward. He's rich. He's immortal. Yeah. He's better looking, I guess, although he has a worse body.
Is that stated explicitly?
Basically. Jacob doesn't wear a shirt the entire second movie.
Hell yeah, dude.
And she's like, wow, puberty really hit you hard.
I would say sun's out, guns out, but the movie makes clear the sun is never out in Forks, Washington. Any closing thoughts on the gender politics of the thing? I mean, we've said it. It is a toxic, abusive relationship that society just missed somehow.
Yeah, I do, which is that it's funny that we were able to sexualize vampires and werewolves in this series so much, because you don't really hear about other sexy monsters. Ben, you pointed out that, you know, Twilight's in the Pacific Northwest, and there's no mention of a sexy Sasquatch.
Yeah, what the fuck? This is Sasquatch erasure. This is...
That's the book I need in my life. I need you to write that for me. That's it.
You know what they say about cryptids with big feet, am I right? There are so many that you could do. You could have fucking sexy succubi or fucking goaded goblins. let's go through the whole list of mythological beings, sexify them.
Yeah, men do it a little bit, I think, with like mermaids and succubi. But the New York Times review of Twilight, this is a quote from them. The premise of Twilight is attractive and compelling. Who hasn't fantasized about unearthly love with a beautiful stranger? I read that and I was like, excuse me? Like, who hasn't? I mean, I haven't. And so I don't know if this is universal for women, but I was just laughing at the idea that like, all women are like, according to the New York Times, want to be with a beautiful, fictional, unearthly creature, which basically means that all women are weebs. They're neckbeards who watch hentai and fetishize about tentacle monsters and have hentai body pillows. Like, Edward Cullen is their waifu.
It really is the adjective unearthly. That's the only problem with that sentence.
Yeah.
I get it. Forbidden fruit, right? Like, you can do it so many ways. You can do it like whatever, Romeo and Juliet, your family disapproves, or like a love with like different class dynamics or whatever. I get it, but unearthly? Like specifically, the idea that who hasn't fantasized about unearthly love with a beautiful figure? All of the love that is possible on Earth is not good enough for you. How dare you?
Also, like vampires aren't from space. Like, what's he talking about? Like, they are by definition earthly.
Let's move on to the politics of Twilight. Non-gender politics, such as they are. Because, I mean, it is, like, not a political work. It's not like it has some kind of political program to it. But I think there are some very, very fun kernels.
Perfect for the 2000s, by the way. Like, another apolitical book from the 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike Katniss Everdeen and The Hunger Games, where I think there is some income inequality stuff in there. There's none of that in Twilight.
No, but some political views shine through that I think are very funny. So, Bella drives a big 50s rusty truck. What could be more American than that? And there's a line where she says, it was one of those solid iron affairs that never gets damaged. The kind you see at the scene of an accident, paint unscratched, surrounded by pieces of the foreign car it had destroyed. Later, lucky for the Toyota Corolla, I stomped on the brake in time. It was just the sort of car my truck would make scrap metal out of. Buy American.
Well, I think to add more context to this, where did Bella get that truck from, Ben?
From Jacob.
Yeah, it was purchased from his family.
Mm-hmm.
He put that motor together by himself. He rebuilt that motor for her.
Not only buy American, buy Native American. Support your local tribe.
Get a Native American car like the Jeep Grand Cherokee.
Oof.
I guess American automakers love to do that. Or there's so many cars. The Pontiac.
Yeah.
And military helicopters too, right?
Aztec, right?
No, I was thinking like military shit. Like you have like the Apache attack helicopter or whatever. There's like a bunch of stuff named after First Nations, which is pretty problematic. But
and getting into that point, there's like a colonialism thread I found throughout Twilight, because the vampires did colonialism. The vampires show up from Europe and they make treaties with the natives. One of the plot lines is like that the vampires are always trying to work around the rules that they have agreed to in these treaties with the werewolves.
Yeah, but unlike actual European colonialists, the werewolves seem to largely abide by the rules. you never see Edward actually go on the reservation in the first book.
Right. And they're not allowed to bite. That's one reason why he can't bite Bella, is he's made a treaty saying that they're not allowed to bite anyone.
I also think that the darkness of the Native American characters in this book is often exaggerated and brought back into your face. I mean, what is Jacob's last name?
Black.
What is Bella's last name?
Swan. Jeez Louise, I fucking missed that. I'm a moron.
And Bella is often talked about being like already naturally very, very pale. There was a joke that when she came from Arizona, wasn't Jessica was like, aren't Arizonans supposed to be like very, very tan? And she's like, well, I don't know. And then obviously the vampires are all very, very pale. So there's a dichotomy here that's being played upon. friend.
Oh, yeah. She comments on everyone's complexion. Yeah. Everyone's complexion.
Every single person.
The vampires, I get. It's part of the lore that they're supposed to be pale. But Bella is also described as pale complexion. There was a really yikesy adjective for Jacob where it was bronzed or something of that nature, which was, yeah, someone used a thesaurus tool on Brown and came up with, like, a fancier sounding word.
Was there ever an adjective that was used to describe him that was, like, a flavor or, like, a food?
Yeah, caramel.
Terrible.
So that was something I feel like you could do in the 2000s.
It's highly exoticizing of the First Nations. And, of course, this would be a nice place to say, Taylor Lautner, not Indigenous, not First Nations.
No.
But, like many Americans, he, quote, has some Cherokee blood on his Meemaw's side or whatever.
He pulls a Johnny Depp and is like, yes, you know, there's Cherokee DNA all across Kentucky and it's in here. And that's literally something every family tells themselves to feel less guilty about their position in America.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Taylor Lautner is almost certainly not Indigenous, even though he claims to be.
Yeah, Jornado, as you said, for the Taylor Lautners and the Johnny Depps of the world, they're probably just sending out yearly emails to their entire family. Do not do 23andMe. Don't do it. We need plausible deniability here.
Absolutely. We can't have a Liz Warren situation on our hands.
Yeah. You know,
we don't want proof.
And I just want to, like, put this on the pod. Thomas King is a First Nations public intellectual from Canada. And he pointed out that two First Nations actors have their star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. One of them is Will Rogers, who was white passing and refused to ever play a First Nations character in Westerns and whatnot. He said, I won't do it. I won't play these tokenized roles. I won't hoot and holler and whatever in your Western to be the savage villain or whatever. The other actor is the guy who played Tonto in The Lone Ranger, who, you know, went on the other side of the spectrum. But these are the two First Nations actors that got recognition for their work. So, yes. Yeah.
And part of that is because people like Johnny Depp were taking the role of Tonto.
Yep. Yeah. When they remade it, it was more racist
than the 40s version. Yeah. Yeah, just to keep moving here, there's like a soy line. The fact that they don't eat humans, yeah. Edward Cullen's clan, Edward compares it to, I can't be sure, of course, but I'd compare it to living on tofu or soy milk. We call ourselves vegetarians, our little inside joke. It doesn't completely satiate the hunger, or rather thirst, but it keeps us strong enough to resist most of the time.
Yeah, hilarious. That's something only an American could write.
One more politics adjacent thing is that in the fall of 2012, Trump went on a tweeting frenzy, which has only really been matched by his frenzy to tweet about Colin Kaepernick. But he tweeted 8 times in October of 2012 upon learning that Kristen Stewart had cheated on Robert Pattinson. He was deeply hurt by this and felt the need to share with the world his thoughts on the matter. He said, Robert Pattinson should not take back Kristen Stewart. She cheated on him like a dog and will do it again. Just watch. He can do so much better.
It's so fucking funny. I love that the fucking MAGA chuds out there think that this man, this fucking lumpy mashed potatoes ass man, is the pinnacle of masculinity, and he is so deeply invested with the Twilight actors' relationship. I'm looking at some of these that you pulled, Jordano. Everyone knows that I am right that Robert Pattinson should dump Kristen Stewart. In a couple of years, he will thank me. Be smart, Robert. Sees himself just giving unsolicited advice to this man he doesn't know.
Yeah, this is the macho man that everybody, you know, loves as their president. He's reading the National Enquirer and tweeting from the bathtub. After Friday's Twilight release, I hope Robert Pattinson will never be seen in public with Kristen. She will cheat on him again. Is this the future president? Or, yeah, is this a quote from Tiger Beat magazine or something?
So many tweets and stories on Stuber Pattinson. Look, it doesn't matter. The relationship will never be the same. It is permanently broken. How is a man who is on his third family going to give advice on how to have a healthy relationship?
I don't think this is about Robert Pattinson at all. I think this is about just joining the media and the internet frenzy that was just like hating Kristen Stewart at this moment.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think you're 100% right. It's not really support for Pattinson so much as it's like a chance to rip on a popular actress
who was going through a horrible moment in her life.
Yeah, this is something I saw in people like looking back at the frenzy around Twilight. Robert Pattinson did have some contempt for the movies that he was getting paid in, and he was loved for it, whereas Kristen Stewart got so much hate.
Also, rewatching the movie, they have shown time and time again that they're great actors. Every project that they've been a part of post Twilight has been incredible performances in every way. So I don't think the blame for how stunted and weird that they seem and feel in this movie, A, should be chalked up to their own acting decisions. I think a lot of it's the direction, which is like a complicated thing to say because this is the only movie, the first one, that has a female director. The rest of she's replaced by three different men afterward for the
wait, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Shortly after this, because they didn't like the direction that it took. And like,
the direction was bad. They put that blue filter over everything. Like,
also like the way that like the camera was moving at all times, like it added to the stuntiness of like their dialogue.
Yeah, they were given a bad script.
Well, so interestingly, the screenplay was written by also a woman, Melissa Rosenberg, and she did the screenplay for the rest of the films. Melissa Rosenberg wrote for the OC. So she's used to writing teenage dialogue.
So, I mean, Robert Pattinson, I think we know is a good actor because like he's been doing well since this movie. You know, he was in The Lighthouse, Batman. I liked him in all of those things. I thought he was a serviceable actor in Twilight. Kristen Stewart, I was watching New Moon and I was groaning constantly because I was like, she is so bad. She's horrible. But I've been rethinking that opinion recently because I know she got nominated apparently for Best Actress for her portrayal of Princess Diana.
Spencer.
Yeah. And I'm like, well, maybe she just didn't have a lot to work with here. Bella is not characterized well. There's not a lot for her to do.
No, there's not. Also, she was also Jean Seberg in that other Amazon movie.
Is she good in it?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, let's wrap up the whole episode just talking about the movie. Yeah, she wasn't given a lot to work with. And I think one thing that really hampers the movie is its fidelity to the source material, where whole passages of dialogue are lifted from this. But the thing is, in the book, it's interspersed with internal monologue, which you don't get in the movie. So there's just a lot of awkward pauses. Yeah, as Giordano said, in the same way that Mexico is always yellow and stuff like Breaking Bad, like they just slap some fucking sepia tone on it. This movie is so blue greenish. It does like, not look good.
You guys are in the Pacific Northwest, remember? Everything's blue here.
Yeah.
And the running, whenever they show a vampire running, it is so laughably bad in that first movie. It looks like a Bollywood movie or something. It's like Flintstone style, feet going back and forth.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, there's an iconic scene in which Bella gets on Edward's back and he scampers up a mountain. And before they do it, he drops the iconic line, not in the book. I was waiting for it. Hold on tight, spider monkey.
Yeah, it's so cringy. I can't do it.
Yeah, your soul leaves your body when you hear it. And the special effects are not good, but essentially what happens is, how do I describe this in an auditory medium? You know how when you're a kid and you want to go up the stairs really fast, you kind of lean forward on your hands and legs like a monkey or whatever going up the stairs? Imagine that action, but suspended on a cable harness, whooping up and kind of windmilling your arms and legs around. And it's just, it looks comically bad.
In terms of things we like about the movie, for one, everybody is beautiful.
Yep.
Yeah.
Edward, Bella, even Charlie is a cute guy, I think, her dad. I mentioned that, in New Moon, Jacob has his shirt off the entire time, and he's got one of the best chests of all time. He looks good. Mr. Big Chest. Was there anything else? Oh, the baseball scene set to Muse was very good.
Fucking rocks, dude.
That was Stephanie's favorite band.
Muse kind of rocks.
Yeah.
The movie is bad, by the way, folks, just so you know. I thought the book was fine. The movie, not good. Not good.
I didn't like it. Upsetting. I really wanted to like, I really did.
It's 2 hours. It needs to be a tight 90. It's too fucking long. Not a lot happens in Twilight.
I would watch a reboot of the first movie because I feel like with modern sensibilities, they could probably make it a lot better. You know,
I think we'll see that in our lifetime. I think we
almost
will.
Almost certainly. Almost certainly. Yeah, sure.
There'll be some nostalgia moment.
Something in the Way by Nirvana playing.
You better hold on tight, spider monkey.
One thing that I actually found kind of interesting about the movie is that the Stephenie Meyer's Mormon politics, there's no drinking in Twilight anywhere. No underage drinking, as well as no sex. But a couple beers sneak into the film. Charlie has a six-pack of beer.
Yeah.
And Jacob's dad also. They drink beer while they watch the game together.
So I mean, I didn't notice that, but I will say that the metaphor for addiction is often used.
I like that a lot, actually. Yeah, so Edward compares his need to drink human blood as being like a heroin addiction.
The line is that he gives Bella is like, you're my own brand of heroin.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And surprisingly, I had not heard that as like an allegory in vampire fiction, that his need to drink blood isn't necessary like a hunger. It's more like a dependency, like a drug addiction.
We should wrap up. What is the lasting impact of Twilight? Obviously, 50 Shades of Grey is the next link in the evolutionary chain.
50 Shades of Grey developed as Twilight fan fiction. And so we have Twilight to thank for 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah. So this thing that it felt like everyone hated got so much public hate disparagement because it was teen girl art, right? I think you can look at this as the same way people looked at boy bands in the early 2000s. Pieces of culture that are marketed to teen girls are only worthy of disparagement and contempt, right? That's generally how it works. And you see this with boy bands. And if enough time goes by, boy bands, now you can like them unproblematically. You know, Brooklyn Nine-Nine could do a cold open. That's about how Andy Samberg's character loves the Backstreet Boys so much. Now it's okay. The statute of limitations on something being teen girls has passed.
Yeah.
But Twilight never got this. And what's crazy is, yeah, like Jordana said at the beginning, every woman I spoke to either read this or watched this. And it did have a lasting effect, even though people looked down on it so much. Twihards, which is what I learned a Twilight fan is called, yep. Twihards were consuming this content so voraciously that it changed the way fan fiction is published. Fan fiction has existed for as long as the internet, probably, but there was so much Twilight fan fiction that was consumed so much. Like, I think people actually print fanfic now. I publish
it. It is, and there's a lot of legal issues that we're attempting to solve right now around what exactly is whose intellectual property.
This changed the game of fandom, like it or not. And sure enough, like, this is a nostalgia pod. I think, Steph, you hit the nail on the head that this shit's going to get the remake treatment eventually. And it already kind of is now, with Stephanie Myers producing the gender-swapped version.
She has also said that she's going to write two more Twilight books, because I think that the way Breaking Dawn ends, like, it's not wrapped up as neatly as Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings or something.
But yeah, any closing thoughts before we wrap up the show?
Thank you for having me. I was really nice to go down a nostalgia road to high school Steph psyche a little bit.
Heck yeah.
Yeah.
If you joined us, well, you consumed our pod, so you don't need to watch or read Twilight. You're welcome. We fell on this grenade for you. Yeah, if you joined us, thanks for listening. As always, like, subscribe, give us 5 stars, write us a review. If you comment on the YouTube, we will read it. As I think I said in the last episode, try and hurt our feelings. Do your worst. No, please don't. I'm actually very
draw sensitive. Blood.
Thanks for listening. Ciao.
Peace.
And big shout out. Thank you to our guest, Steph, for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
All right. Ciao. Bye.
It's getting kind of hard to believe things are going to get better. And if I see Van Helsing, I swear to the Lord I will slay him. Ha 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 ha. He'd take it from me, but I swear I won't let it be so. Ah, 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 blood will run down his face when he is decapitated. Ah.